One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Whether you're a brand, large business, small business, or an individual, you need customers. And the chances are some of your potential customers are probably listening to this podcast right now. From history...
When Napoleon led Boulogne for a year...
Politics...
If that person is poor, it's a bad neighbourhood. Then you have the disproportionate police brutality, which is meted out instantly at people of colour.
Culture...
Had they written it that Chris called an ambulance for hours straight away, we wouldn't have learnt about the severity of alcohol withdrawal either. Well done to the writers. Thank you for making a wonderful podcast, but I'd give Rotherham a miss. Bye!
The Rotherham Tourist Board.
Geekdom.
The flag is a graphic symbol, not a verbal symbol. You know, why don't we just write France on the flag? I mean, we laugh when you think of putting a country's name on a flag.
Society or music.
Young people began to turn away from their parents' ethics and their style of dress, and they began to dance to a new type of music.
Royfield Brown's podcasts are downloaded just under 100,000 times a month. So putting your message here could well be worth it. If you have something to sell or promote, why not email royfield@gmail.com and hear your product or service promoted.
It was the best of time. It was the worst of time.
She was the people's princess.
We shall fight on the beaches.
Away, man. These are the things that made England.
We shall fight on the landing ground.
These are the things that made England.
I have the body, but of a weak and feeble woman.
These are the things that made England.
And a king of England, too.
These are the things that made England.
Cry God for Harry!
And these are the things that made England.
England! And St. George!
These are the things that made England.
Hello and welcome to The Things That Made England. This is the show where we select anything from a number of topics and decide whether it is a worthy thing that has made England the country it is today. And today with me I have Mr. David Crowther. David, please introduce
Hello.
Yourself.
My name is David Crowther and I am a podcaster and I apologise for that.
Yes, unfortunately, we're not joined today by our colleague Royfield Brown because he's decided that he's celebrating something that goes on in America around the end of November. I can't remember really what it is. He's eating that very thoroughly British meal, roast turkey.
Oh, I still remember what it's about. It's about our celebration of getting rid of a bunch of lemon suckers. Is that right?
Yes.
People who disapprove of everything. Yes.
And we get to party.
We get to party. Like a picture of John Calvin, what somebody once posted on Twitter and said, this is John Calvin, and whatever you're doing, he doesn't approve.
Excellent.
That's always quite a good historical joke on Twitter. Anyway, so I'm going to do, Luke, I am going to do the British Constitution.
Mm.
You might notice that this is a program called The Things That Made England. And I'd like at this point to invoke Rule 34B, which actually we've invoked in pretty much every episode, which is, although that it's clearly British constitution now, it has a deep impact on England, and therefore it can count as a thing that made England, even if it's developed under a British flag for some of its life at least. You accept my invocation of Rule 34B?
I very much do. I think that makes absolute sense, and we'll be able to play along with that.
Excellent. You're most compliant. So look, what you're going to get, if we're going to get tonight, everybody, just so you're aware, is a long, boring history lesson from me, and then 2 minutes of questions and debate at the end, and then we can all let you go to bed, all right?
Yes, I'm not going to be saying an awful lot on this one because my knowledge of the British Constitution is extremely limited. So you're flying alone there, Anne.
Well, that is actually quite interesting because, you know, there was, during all the Brexit debate or whatever it was, one of those things, there was a poll of the British where the question was asked, do you think that your MP, what you have just elected, ought to A, do exactly what you tell them to do at any given point, or B, behave in the best interests of the all the constituencies when they are in Parliament? Which, what is the right answer for a representative democracy, Luke?
I know this one. B.
Yes, correct. Do you know how many, what percentage of people said B as opposed to A?
50.
God, blimey. 17. Yeah, 17% understood the very basis of their democracy.
That is slightly troubling, isn't it?
Now, look, so you tell me, Luke, if I may call you Luke, what your, as opposed to Mr. Baxter, what are your preconceptions about the British Constitution? Give me three things.
It all started with the Magna Carta, and that was the basis for everything.
Okay.
It's not written down anywhere.
Uh-huh.
And we're a monarchy.
Yeah, okay. A constitutional monarchy, right? Okay, well, let's come back to those themes. They're all good ones. So, you're absolutely right. We tend to trace the origin of our parliamentary democracy to Magna Carta, which is what year? I should, if to give you a clue, it's around about lunchtime.
1214.
12:15, actually, but yes, indeed, you have lunch a minute later than me. I was like that joke. Magna Carta sales at running me 12:15, just around about lunchtime. Anyway, there you go. So look, we tend to trace it back to Magna Carta, but in actual fact, there are signs a little bit early of the basis of monarchy is that the lord and the basis of lordship, and this is not just Germanic, this is everywhere, Celtic in particular. In Germanic lordship, it tends to be around about territory, that the lord owns the land, and the lord owns the land. So let's not have any of this stuff about, oh, you know, we've got rights in it. Just doesn't exist. I mean, there's a theoretical elective element of Germanic lordship, but really, just like in Celtic lordship, you own the people.
But why do you say Germanic? Because it's Anglo-Saxon based?
Yes, essentially our traditions trace back more to Germanic rather than Celtic. But obviously Celtic's very important, Wales and Ireland and parts of Scotland. And that model of lordship, and many models of lordship, are about the ownership of people rather than the ownership of land. The sept, the clan, owns the land. So that's the same in Africa and South America, I believe. So the concept of us thinking now that actually it's about justice and, you know, rights of the people and consent and everybody's got a say, and that just doesn't exist. There is a requirement on, so there's a coronation oath under Edgar in the 10th century where the king has got some responsibilities. They have to govern wisely, they have to protect the church, and they have to consult, but there is no requirement to govern according to the will of the people or with any restraint. So the first example we have of some restraint is actually
Because that is sort of one of the myths about it, that the sort of Anglo-Saxon Witan was a bit more democratic than, you know, the Normans that followed.
Yeah, indeed. And that is a major myth, Victorian myth, that, you know, the Norman yoke, the removal of Anglo-Saxon liberty. And really, it's largely tripe. Nobody's really sure if the Witan actually exists. But if it did, it's like a precursor to the Magnum Concilium of the Normans, which is the king consulting with his great men and the king being part of a court with the great men, which is in fact, a law court that brings judgment as well as a court of governance. So even if it did exist, and clearly Anglo-Saxon kings consult with their great men, it's not a representative assembly in any way. In 1014, actually, there is the first sign. Do you know who was king in 1014?
Ethelred the Unready.
He gets kicked out by Canute and makes a comeback. And there is a very famous couple of lines in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle which says Ethelred, along the lines of the Ethelred, promised to rule in accordance with the laws of the land. And that's the first indication, really, of a king promising to be bound by some kind of rules. But of course, it's really Magna Carta. I mean, there's a lot of, in Henry II's time, there's an awful lot of legal changes, which are very interesting. If you're, you know, if you've had about 10 pints on a Saturday night, they're compelling. But if you haven't, really, they're not. 1215, Magna Carta. Now then, what is Magna Carta, Luke?
It's just a peace treaty between the king and the barons after a civil war.
Absolutely right. So there's that question which goes around for ages saying, oh, Magna Carta is the cornerstone of our liberty. But its genesis was nothing to do with that. The lords were not thinking about the future. They were not thinking about a constitution, nor were they thinking generally, although there's a bit of an exception to this, about their fellow citizens, their fellow subjects. They had a bunch of feudal complaints, including the excessive use, for example, of fish weirs on the River Thames, a provision which I think lasts till about the 1970s, actually. And they wanted to sort all those out and define them. So, for example, the king could not coerce a woman into getting married. They set a particular fee for an heir coming into their wardship. Feudal stuff. But there are a couple of reasons to take that analysis with a pinch of salt. I mean, historians love saying it because they love saying things which debunk myths. But there are a couple
of
reasons
to
argue.
That's what you
told me to say. Is that right? Sure.
Sorry.
And actually, strangely attractive, Luke. You know, for a moment I was aroused. And now you've just blown it. Anyway, because actually Magna Carta, there are a couple of exceptional things in it, actually. And actually, one of the principles in Magna Carta that is very strong is the principle that process must precede judgment. In many societies, there's none of that. There is the king decides you're going to slam you in jail. The king slams you in jail and that's that, or executes you or whatever it might be. So, I mean, that is a really important clause. Clause 38, I think, or clause 49. No free man shall be seized or imprisoned or stripped of his rights or possessions or outlawed or exiled or deprived of his standing in any way, nor will we proceed with force against him or send others to do so, except by lawful judgment of his equals and the law of the land. And then clause 40 is, to no one will we sell, to no one deny or delay right or justice. So those are two big clauses of Magna Carta. And 39, no free man shall be seized or imprisoned, blah, 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 is also important because in about five places, basically your naysayers about Magna Carta say, oh, come on, look, this is just a load of aristos stitching up things with the king because they're hacked off with him. And he's, you know, King John has been a tyrant. It's got nothing to do with the rest of us. But that's not actually true. And in fact, I mean, 85% of the population is excluded from Magna Carta because 85% of the population is not free, but they're bondsmen, they're serfs. But it does say no free man. So it talks about free men, not nobles. And that's exceptional in European history. Not until the Golden Bull of 1350 is there another example of that. All the other agreements of any kind of similarity are with aristocracy. So there is in Magna Carta stuff which will become important, and very quickly, because I've warbled too long, there's another clause which sets up the principle of a council of 25 barons who will monitor the implementation of Magna Carta. Now, that's got rid of within months, but that's a relief. That's a principle of saying, look, the king is not above the law. Even if the king, the big paradox, of course, is that the king makes the law in 1215. So how can the king be above the stuff he promulgates? Nonetheless, in principle, here is a statement that the king is not above the law. So there we go. Nonetheless, it's a peace treaty. 90% of it is about sorting out feudal dues. So a wrap. But then Magna Carta is incredibly important in the future because it's rather opaque, actually. And, well, first of all, it gets reissued. It becomes a touchstone over the next 100 years. Or whenever the king's in trouble or the barons are cross with him, they say, right, you reissue Magna Carta. And you say you're going to work by that again. So it becomes a touchstone of an agreement, of a set of rules that the king's going to abide by. Secondly, because it's rather opaque and vague and all the rest of it, and in vagueness lies freedom. Precision is a disaster in any walk of life, except possibly science. Vagueness rules. And because it's so vague, people put things on it. So in the 1970s, a couple of very famous historians, I think it's Holt and Bogdaner, had two completely different interpretations of the same clause. So how is everybody else expected to know exactly what they mean? So in the 17th century, in the Civil War, honest John Lilburn says Magna Carta is the basis of our liberty, and it does these things. There's a very famous jurist called Edmund Cook, whose name is spelt C-O-K-E, and therefore everybody calls him Edmund Coke. And if anybody says that, you need to, you need to glass him. Well, that's probably a bit extreme, to be honest. Maybe. And he says, yeah. You know, look, maybe, yes, that Magna Carta is the basis of our liberties. It is the statement that the king is not above the law. A lot of that is tripe, but it means something to people. So in 1610, the Charter of Virginia, for example, is based around Magna Carta. There are several clauses in the American Constitution which clearly owe their genesis to Magna Carta. And in America, I think, I mean, Americans can get in touch with us and tell me I'm wrong, but actually the reverence in America for Magna Carta is far higher than it is in Loughborough, for example.
Or Britain as well. Yes, I mean, this is perhaps something I should have asked right from the beginning. But what defines a constitution? Because, you know, what is the difference between Magna Carta, which is a charter, which really feels like just a set of laws, and something that could be described as a constitution?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I do not know the answer, but I would guess and say people set out to write a constitution, don't they? And at the moment, Chile, I think, is actually rewriting its constitution. And there's a very... Yeah. well-defined process around doing that. You know, it's a convention. Okay, so that's Magna Carta. I've warbled enough about that. Then one tends to jump to 1258.
De Montfort.
Indeed.
This is a quiz more than a show.
It is, isn't it? Well, I'm trying to get some interactivity going, darling. You know?
No, it's very good.
Okay, thank you. Well, at least I'm trying. So the Provisions of Oxford, basically Simon de Montfort, gets the barons together against the king, who's Henry III is not as bad a king as John, but he is bumbling. And in 1258, the Provisions of Oxford again confirm that the king is subject to the law, that appointments by the king to official positions must be made in consultation with a council of barons, which is revolutionary because the king was free to appoint whoever he wanted to. That's the principle of all his ministers. And the inclusion of a populace, the free population as a whole. And of course, by 1600, well, we're 1550, all Englishmen are free. There are no more serfs in England. So it becomes, the free man becomes more and more relevant as we go through.
And Simon de Montfort, I mean, he's a bit of a sort of mythical character as well. I mean, he's like the sort of first Democrat and the lover of freedom. And how much of that is true?
It's a very difficult question because Simon de Montfort was a very aristocratic, big believer in aristocracy and a very difficult man. But he puts this stuff in. You know, he also believes that this is about the free men as a whole. He is the one who insists on the promulgation, the first promulgation of Parliament. And Parliament, representation in Parliament, includes all three estates, the estates being the clergy, the nobility, and the towns and common men. So this is it. This is the invention of Parliament. And it's the Scots try to argue that they did it first, but, you know, really they didn't.
And why is that the invention of Parliament? Because suddenly the king has to have his appointments approved.
It's the role of Parliament is severalfold. So it is to the opportunity for the people to present petitions. The presenting of the petitions is crucial, actually, because it starts off people presenting petitions to the king and the king saying, OK, right, we'll go away and I'll either make some statute law or I won't. So that is the process whereby lawmaking begins to be centred in Parliament. And there is this principle of British constitution about the king in Parliament, which will become much more relevant under the Tudors, we'll come back to. And as they go by, the making of statutes becomes much more political. So there's an occasion with his son, Edward I, where rather than the Commons going and saying, right, okay, you asked for taxation, and I'm terribly sorry. Of course, the main thing about Parliament is the king cannot make extraordinary taxation without Parliament. That's the biggest thing. He can collect his feudal dues, he can collect revenue from the crown lands, but he can't tax the people without their consent. This thing of petitioning gets to where the Commons actually begin to say, well, look, okay, King, rather than us voting on taxation and then presenting our petitions, we're going to present these petitions. And if you say okay to them, well, then we might grant you your taxation. So gradually that power relationship begins to change and it becomes a negotiable. And it's a slow process, but that's one of the methods by which the balance of power between King and the Commons changes. Under Edward I, you get a lot of legal changes. So the Statute of Westminster 1275 amends the first, has the first major statutes which are specifically designed to amend common law made in assemblies, which can be described as Parliament. So now Parliament is the lawmaking body. Before, the king could just make the law. He could do a proclamation so there it is. Now he can't. And that there's a lot of argument about that. And although there isn't a civil war, it gets quite close, actually, under Edward I.
And sorry, So Simon de Montfort lost that civil war, and the Statutes of Oxford, did they stay in place even though he was, you know, well, killed by Edward I?
Yeah.
Wasn't he?
Many of them did. Right. So basically Edward I, I mean, although he gets Simon de Montfort and he cuts his ghoulies off and kills him and sticks ghoulies in his mouth. And, you know, he's not a gentleman, Edward I, but then, you know, you're a mock Scot, so you know that.
I've seen Braveheart, so yeah, I know all about that.
Point. Yeah. But many of the provisions of Oxford remain because, in general, there is a kind of myth about medieval history and actually general history, the development of the British Constitution, very much a Victorian thing, actually, a Whig thing, which is that this is a process of struggle over the ages where the king gives a little bit, the barons make a fuss, the good people of England force a few concessions out the king, and that it's a general continuous fight for freedom, which ends up in the glory of the British Constitution, and as John Bright said, the mother of all parliaments. That's really tripe, actually. It's very teleological. You know, you're looking at the end point and reading backwards. You know, it's up, down, it's forward, back, And also, yeah. The barons did not want to clip the wings of the king. Almost at no point do they want to do that. What they want to do is for the king to govern well. So if you think about Magna Carta, we will not deny justice. That's not a sign that they want to restrain the king. They want more royal justice. It's absolutely implicit in that clause. So this thing about it being a struggle between the people and the king for more power and being a gradual process is wrong. The barons are looking to work more effectively and retain the king. So many of the provisions survive because Edward sees actually that they're reasonable complaints by the barons. So where are we? We must move on because I'm being deeply, deeply dull. There are moments which you don't really notice. So Edward II, for example, is very interesting. There are some ordinances in 1311 which talk about restrictions on the rights of the king, subject to the aristocracy. One of the crucial things about that is everybody gets really hacked off with Edward II because he's really good at digging ditches, but he's rubbish at being a king. And so they get him in a room and they say they're going to depose this king. And actually, you know, Edward II is deposed. This is a radical thing, you know, deposing a king, God's anointed. And how do they get around this? They get around this by saying, well, look, we're not deposing the king. We are deposing this chap called Edward Plantagenet. There right. is a difference between the king in his role and the biological king. So these two things within the same person. And actually in 1327, with the deposition of Edward II, the way it's put is that Parliament said that the king had been deposed by the will of the people. So by the 14th century, you've got that concept of the will of the people and the will of the people being somehow superior. Now, it doesn't to the king. That's an incredibly radical concept. It gets lost a bit in Edward II, actually. But it comes up again in some very famous legal texts by Fortescue in the 15th century. He claims that it's the will of the people that is sovereign. And that's quite a concept. I mean, people still argue about
it. It's the rubbish kings that do a power of good for our freedoms and our constitution. If it's John Henry III.
Yeah. I mean, even Edward I, yeah. who we see as a very powerful king, an effective king, even he... all the changes happen when he begins to, when he has a bad patch, as it were.
And is that with Edward I, would that be tied back to the taxation issue? Was it because he was fighting so many wars exactly. that he was more in hock to Parliament? Good.
Absolutely right. Yeah. So he's fighting a war in France. He's fighting a war in Scotland. He's just spent vast amounts of money building castles in Wales and he's skint. And let's get to 1376 and the good Parliament. Edward III, as you know, is one of our greatest kings. Nobody killed more French people.
Tops.
The good Parliament in 1376, so this is when the king is in his dying days. He's basically infirm. He's dominated by his mistress, Alice Perrers. And the good Parliament, what emerges there is a chap called Peter de la Mer, I think, who is our first Speaker of Parliament, establishes the right of the Commons to impeach the king's ministers. They also have a speaker, so the absolutely fundamental role in the operation of Parliament, the speaker that is neither of any party and is a representative of the Commons. And the Commons coming out of the shadow of the Lord as an independent body, and that's really interesting about the British Constitution, is the bicameral nature of Parliament, which is, again, I think, pretty unique. That gives the Commons more freedom to be independent of the power of the Lords.
But even at that stage, does it have yes. that sort of bicameral nature where the Commons would be proposing laws
I think
and
lords
the Lords approving
propose
it?
Propose laws. In fact, I think even the King can. But the point is that these people sit separately. The Commons isn't an election process. It's a selection process. So in the Shires, the magnates will sit down and say, I think it's my turn to appoint the representative that goes. I think we'll have Sir Alan, and they go along and they say, you're going to be elected. So we're not talking democracy here. We are talking, the magnates are still all powerful and they're electing their interest. Nonetheless, the Commons here in the good Parliament is making decisions that the Lords hate. So what do we go to next? Well, of course, Tudors. Let's have Henry VIII. So everybody moans about the fact that we all do Tudors, don't they? And when we talk about the British Empire, no doubt we'll talk about the fact that, Oh, we don't talk about the British Empire enough. Why do we always talk about the Tudors? Actually, I didn't do Tudors at all when I was at school. I did 8 years, that's 4 years of the British Empire, but that's, you know, neither here nor there. Anyway, but the point about Tudors is that the Tudors is critical to the formation of the British state. There is no more crucial period as it may be the 19th century. But even then, this lays the groundwork. In the Tudor time, the Act of Supremacy, the break with Rome and the reformation of the church is all done through Parliament. Suddenly, the authority of lawmaking and the authority of the English state is the king in Parliament. And actually, Henry even says this himself. People talk hysterically about Henry VIII as being this horrible tyrant and all the rest of it. Henry VIII wasn't a tyrant. Everything he did through Parliament, and he accepted that he's never more powerful, he says, than when I am the king in Parliament. So it's just this concept of the two working together. It's no longer that the fount of all law is the king. It's no, the authority of law is the king in Parliament, not the king separately, or indeed the Parliament yet separately. Parliament is not yet sovereign.
Is he literally in Parliament?
Yeah. Yes.
Does he sit in Parliament?
Kings still go to Parliament. I mean, they don't go all the time, but they certainly open Parliament with a speech, or actually they get their Chancellor or the Archbishop of Canterbury to open Parliament, but they can go. You know, there's none of this black rod stuff. That doesn't appear until the Civil War.
Yeah. One more question. Yeah. During the whole Brexit thing, they spoke a lot about invoking the sort of power of Henry VIII. What would that be when the executive can sort of stamp absolute power?
Yeah, I can't remember what that was about. In Henry VIII's time, it was also the primacy of statute was established. So the king can still make proclamations, actually. But actually, even Henry rarely uses proclamation for purely administrative stuff. Statute law is now supreme.
That's the exact point about the Brexit thing. It was the proclamations that they were using. There was something that Henry VIII did, but other people didn't.
So then, can we must hop forward?
Haven't we skipped Wales?
We have skipped Wales. 1542, Cromwell takes a policy in Wales, which actually will be quite successful, as it won't be in Ireland, which is to say, well, look, we need to bring this kingdom together. And what we need to do is remove all the funny franchises. So you've got marcher lords who are sitting around, you know, when the king's does not run in their lands. You've got the Palatine of Chester where the king's doesn't run. You've got the Palatine of Durham where the king's writ doesn't run. This is all pens. What we need is a single nation state. And that is a process which is European wide. Interestingly, James VI of Scotland also copies this and tries to ban Gaelic as a language. Actually, the Scottish Parliament tries to ban Gaelic as a language. And they send a whole load of lowland Scots to places like Lewis to try and settle it with non-Highland and Island people, good, solid, honest lowland Scots. And there is this process. And in Spain, the Moriscos are butchered. I think about 92,000 of them get cancelled. In France, they've got this problem with Huguenots, but essentially, in the ancien regime, they're trying to create one single state. There's this process of nation building and creating more taxation to carry out the Valois-Habsburg Wars. So there's a general European movement towards state formation. And the Tudor times is when that really happens. And you get this sense of patriotism towards England. England is a thing. There is a public space where England is discussed and politics are discussed, which is quite new. Happens a little bit in the Wars of the Roses when everybody gets behind Warwick the Kingmaker. But with printing and with chapbooks and ballads and news broadsheets, this public space is a part of that nation formation which the Tudors really focus on. Is that boring enough?
No.
Good.
Keep going.
Quite cool. Anyway, we're talking about Wales. Sorry, 1542, Cromwell wants to create a single nation state, as does his boss. And therefore, the acts in 1542 bring Wales into a united kingdom with England. The Welsh laws of Hywel Dda are replaced, cancelled, and the legal processes happen in English. the English don't try to suppress the Welsh language or anything like that. But it's just that the operation of law is in English.
Do they never try and suppress the Welsh language?
No, it's an interesting debate, this, because, of course, the English get accused of everything, of course. I said slightly bitterly, and a lot of it is just tripe. So, you know, the Wales, I guess, because of the war of 1284 and conquest, can always complain that, you know, they had their freedoms taken away and all the rest of it with some justice, you know, because they were conquered. And this is part of that. But in actual fact, and a Welshman can tell me I'm all wrong, but the relationship between...
Welsh woman will, I think.
Sorry, Welsh woman, yeah, probably Fiona. But the relationship is much more cordial and successful than it is in Ireland. Scotland's a different case, obviously, because they're an independent nation who decide to join a union. But part of that is in the Reformation, that in Wales, a Gaelic version of the Bible and the Catechism are produced, and Protestantism therefore succeeds in Wales. And there's a gentry which grows up in Wales, which finds advantage in being united with England. So although I'm sure the Welsh always resent, you know, the fact that they live back to such a big neighbour, and, you know, they're lost in the constitutional process because they're so much smaller, and because they were conquered, and because the Lords of Hywel-Dda were cancelled. There's all that stuff to deal with. In terms of language, there are some events where English employers, so like Port Albert and the steelworks and the coalworks, where I am told employers refuse to allow people to speak Welsh because they're worried that they're plotting, right, you know, strikes and all the rest of it. And I think in schools, therefore many children are, you know, forced not to speak Welsh. But like, it's the same in Ireland and Scotland, actually. The Gaelic and Gaelic languages begins to fail to degree, because you need to speak English to get a job properly in the lowlands and in industry. In Ireland, the Catholic Church works very hard to suppress Gaelic. Never at any point does the British Parliament legislate to stop people speaking local languages.
So unlike Catalan or Basque.
Indeed. You heard it here first. One of the many false accusations to be made against the poor old English. 1628 then, Charlie I, too short to be king. Fantastic joke, isn't it? What was that? Monty Python, the king, started the reign at 5'8" and ended the reign at 4'8" or something. Very funny. Anyway, the Petition of Rights, 1628, ruled that the king could not, by prerogative alone, levy taxation, imprison without trial, or billet troops, or impose martial law. So billeting troops, martial law is critical, but billeting troops as well. In France, Louis XIV basically rubs out Protestantism, the Huguenots, partly by killing them, partly by forcing them, but partly by billeting troops on them. So you install a bunch of roughneck soldiers who could die at any time on a family, and they can do anything with that family. So Louis uses that technique to basically say to Protestants, look, if you're Protestant, you'll get troops billeted on you and they'll ruin your life and destroy your finances. Or you can be a Catholic, in which case you won't have troops billeted on you. So it's not a small issue, billeting troops. So the Charles says, hey, this sucks. And you get the personal rule where he doesn't call Parliament for however many years it is, 11 years or whatever. The Civil War is rather interesting, or the Civil Wars, as one must call them. Not allowed to exclude the Scots and the Irish from the conversation, for good reason, actually. You could certainly go far enough and say that without the Scots and the Irish, there might not have been an English Civil War. The English might not have had the money and the strength to...
They started
against the king. So it is, you know, the War of the Three Kingdoms is a relevant way of talking about it. So look, you get the ship money case, local lad, John Hampden, who refuses to pay ship tax, and that absolutely sinks the ship tax, actually, if you'll pardon the pun. John Hampden gets married to a local lass here in a place called Purton, which is just down the road from my hood. Anyway, I don't want to talk about John Hampden. He's one of those famous figures of English independence. But you've never heard of him, have you?
And he was important in the shipping trade in Oxfordshire.
Yes, indeed. No, he's a lawyer, actually, in Aylesbury.
Aylesbury,
a seven-gated Aylesbury.
But just down the road.
Yes, indeed, just down the road, cheek by jowl.
I don't think seven.
No. Was it Thebes that was seven-gated, or was just many-gated? Anyway, forget it. So then you get the whole shebang about the English Revolution, Civil War, whatever you call it, and Oliver Cromwell, the most enigmatic figure in English history. What comes out of it? What comes out of the Civil War? All the changes that happen up to 1641 are all accepted by Charles II and remain in place. But you know, it's not really a hill of beans, those changes. I mean, there are things like the abolition of Star Chamber, for example. So there are some achievements, but really you wouldn't have, you know, let a quarter of a million people die for the purposes of that. There are two things, really, there are four things, because you never expect the Spanish. Because one is the extraordinary flowering of debate that comes with the Civil Wars, the extraordinary ideas, the Putney debates, the Putney debate. John Harrison says the meanest he has, just as the greatest he has a life to live. This idea of one man, one vote that you get from the levelers, but property holders, it's worth saying. You know, this extraordinary flowering of ideas and debate, which never really go away. There's a quote I threw at you earlier that the French in 1789 take Benzedrine, and some clever historian said that. And they just keep on, you know, throughout the 19th century, they keep having rebellions because they can't get away from the habit. Well, the habit of debate, even though censorship comes back and all the rest, that never goes away again. There is now a very strong public space in England.
That's a really, really interesting. I'd never thought of it from that point of view, that even though they didn't win anything, it was actually sort of broadened the mind, and it was actually made people understand that these things could be
indeed
possible.
The ideas that you get. And I think the influence of the English Revolution actually is always rather underplayed. That here is the first time. I mean, there are writings and all the rest of it, and ideas that people have, and Fortescue and all the rest of it. But these things are public, you know, especially in London. This is the first time when people have really gone around saying, "Hey, do you think everybody ought to have their vote as long as they've got some property? Hey, do you think?" But there's this massive flowering of ideas and all the, you know, the Quaker stuff.
And the diggers. I mean, a lot of what the diggers were proposing, I think, is relevant to today with you know, climate change, et cetera.
Absolutely. Yes, a different way of life, a different form of society, whereas society was incredibly conservative. And actual fact, in Britain, I think you do lose some of that radicalism. You know, Britain remains a very hierarchical society, it's got to be said. The second thing that comes out of it is that this is the only time we have a written constitution, the heads of agreement written by Henry Ireton, amongst others, Cromwell's son-in-law. So, you know, a lot of good that did us.
That's quite interesting then. So we have had a written constitution.
Instruments of government, actually, I think it's called. And then the trial of the king, of course, we chopped the king's head off. It wasn't done in a corner, as Cromwell famously said. We didn't shove a hot, red-hot iron poker up his backside. We didn't starve him to death like Richard II in secret. We stood in front of the world and said, "We believe this king is subject to the law and has done wrong and should suffer the consequences of his actions." And wow, you know, that's a big thing. So if essentially that establishes the principle that all power now rests with the commons, or at least that is what is asserted in that process, that the commons is sovereign. I'm not sure that's said there, but that is a absolutely fundamental principle of modern constitution in the Britain, that Parliament is sovereign, and there's a whole lot of problems with that. But anyway, so look, I've got to get on with it because it's just boring as hell. So the 1660 settlement of Charles II, when he came back, Declaration of Breda and all the rest of it, most of which he sort of reneges on, or it gets reneged on in some ways. In 1679, you get the Habeas Corpus Act, which extends an act in 1640. So it's one of the things that comes out of the Civil War. There was something else. There was the fourth thing of the Spanish information. Oh, yes, the last thing, ironically, is that for the first time in English history, the government, the executive, is properly resourced. So we went to war because we thought the king was being a tyrant and trying to exact all these weird taxes out of us. By the end of the Civil War, taxation was way higher than it had been. Because one of the problems is that the English were too mean to give their king enough money to govern properly. And the Civil War sorts that one out. Which is kind of ironic, isn't it? But anyway, there you go. 1689, Bill of Rights, raising of the revenues of the Crown, required a grant of Parliament again. There's the Act of Toleration in 69, which gives freedom of worship to those who took the oath of supremacy and allegiance. Now, it's interesting because, of course, it remains true that there is Catholic persecution, but that persecution is about taking high office, and that remains in place. But in terms of Catholics practicing their religion, persecution is over effectively by the Act of Toleration. It doesn't say it in the Act. It only gives it to people who make a declaration denying transubstantiation is the wording. But what it basically says is nobody is going to prosecute Catholics for practicing their religion or anybody for practicing their religion. It is a dead letter. There is still,
but they still can't hold positions, or
they can't, you know, they still can't
have anything legal.
Yeah, so there is a level of persecution, but it's a very far cry now from the 16th century. You don't get Catholics persecuted simply for practicing their religion. Queen Anne's very interesting constitutionally. Because they want to make changes, and what happens is Anne agrees to use her prerogative to create loads of peers to get acts from the Commons through the Lords. And you get a precedent then, which is used.
When are we getting the Glorious Revolution? Isn't this around now?
Oh, I've just hopped over the Glorious Revolution, actually.
It's going to be a bit more glorious than that.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, that happened. Well, you know, is it really glorious?
Apparently not.
I mean, basically, you've got a situation where you... not that glorious. I mean, I'm sure I'll make it so, but it's glorious if you're English and Protestant.
What is it? I think you might need to just tell us.
Yeah, okay, sorry. So James II is a firm Catholic, and this is before the Test Act, the Bill of Rights. And so the Bill of Rights is a response to the fact that everybody says, I'm sorry, we've told you before, we don't want a Catholic on the throne, and you've just become a Catholic, so you've got to go. You know, freedom and tyranny and all the rest of it. But out of it comes the Bill of Rights and the Act of Toleration. So it does have an impact on constitutional freedom. In the Bill of Rights in 89, for example, freedom of speech was guaranteed in parliamentary debates. So you could not prosecute somebody under proceedings in Parliament for something.
And that's still used quite a lot, isn't it? Where they can insult people.
Yeah, that's still... Judges, also very interesting Bill of Rights, were no longer dismissible at the pleasure of the king, and their paid salaries, I think, is particularly given the situation with the power of the executive in the UK, it's very important. Okay, so that's the Glorious Revolution. It's a matter of religious tolerance, which comes in 1689. William III grants religious tolerance to a degree, which effectively means anybody can practice their religion, but Catholics are still disadvantaged in high office. And the Bill of Rights, which makes a lot of freedoms in Parliament clear. We have our first Prime Minister in Robert Walpole, acknowledged, although it's not a formal position, acknowledged to now be our first Prime Minister in fact, de facto.
But it was a bit of a joke, wasn't it, when they called him Prime Minister? It was sort of, you know, oh, you think you're above yourself.
Oh, is that right? Yes, I suppose it could be, couldn't it? Well, a bit of bloody hell, Robert Walpole does everything.
Prime Minister.
So late 1770s, you begin to get something quite new, which is public radicalism. most of the rebellions up to the emergence of radicalism are not about revolution. They're not really about enforcing change. They're about conservatism. They're about saying, look, king, you've changed something here. That's not right. So all the Tudor rebellions, like John Kett's rebellion and Jack Cade's rebellion in 1450, and they're all about saying, look, you landlords, you powerful people, you've changed stuff. We want to go back to the way the life was. Radicalism changes all that. Radicalism say, hey, we want things to be different. We, the people, we want to reform Parliament and we want a greater part of this pie. It's quite clear what the limits are still. You know, you're still talking about people who own property. There is a principle that says you don't deserve a vote if you don't have a stake in the country, and that means owning property. So that's a principle that goes through quite late. And William Pitt, who I think is one of our better prime ministers, actually, but I know he's a conservative, so you probably hate me saying that. He tries to reform Parliament in a mild way and gets debunked. And of course, it's him under him that the Act of Union with Ireland happens in 1801, which is supposed to be all tied up with Catholic emancipation. And then George III and the go back and the Tories go back on the promise, and Pitt resigns. So look, there you've got a politician of principle. In 1829, under the Catholic Emancipation kerfuffle, where again, I think it was a threat of creation of peers in that and the Great Reform Act of 1832, Bagehot writes, he writes that the king no longer has the power to refuse assent. Okay. So that had been one of the few remaining powers of the king, as the Hanoverians had basically, you know, gradually conceded the power of Parliament. And it's critical now because, you know, people say, what's the power of the monarch now? Well, it's to refuse assent. Well, you know, that can't happen. So through the 19th century, you get a whole load of little piecemeal developments towards extending the franchise and making representative government what we think of representative government. I think one of the interesting things about British constitutional history is there's a tendency to think about, oh, it's not real representation, it's not real democracy until we get to one man, one vote, one woman, one vote. And I think that's, again, a teleological view, that in actual fact, people, not everybody wanted or believed in one person, one vote. That was inimical to the way society ran. And when we think about representation, we need to think about its context at the time, that society had a representation, broadly speaking, that they thought was appropriate. And the radicals changed that a lot because the radicals changed the dials. So in 1848, you get the Great Chartism movement at the time of revolution all around Europe, and it's a real panicky moment for the government, but they have it and they don't rub it out. But actually it's supposed to fail because they failed to get the law changed in 1848.
And what were they specifically trying to get?
I'll get, they have six demands of the Chartists, and the point I was going to make, and I'll find what they are, but the point is that within 30 years of their six demands, five are achieved by law. And the other one, the sixth one, was potty, which is about having an annual elections. So it actually succeeds. It succeeds in a very British way, that by debate and by protest and through the radicals saying, hey, we want change, the dial of debate gets moved. You know, for what was completely unacceptable on day A actually becomes, well, everybody believes that now. So they wanted a vote for every man 21 years of age and over. They wanted a secret ballot, which happens by 1872, I think, so that the, you know, the landlord can't come along and say, hey, vote the right way or your rent goes up. No property qualification for members of Parliament.
Yeah.
So, you know, Parliament can't continue to be completely dominated by very rich people. And the fourth was payment of members. So, you know, anybody can become a member of Parliament. Equal constituencies. So the constituencies were kind of like, some were 100,000 with one member. Some places had no members. And the Reform Act had some impact on that, but not complete. And then annual parliamentary elections, which is just a silly idea anyway. So the thing about radicalism is that some of its success, you know, Thomas Paine, you remember the Wilkes and all these people, and you think, well, look, actually, isn't the English state just incredibly conservative and doesn't change, just not happen very much? Well, it happens, but it happens slowly. And there is some justice in that statement that, you know, the thing about the British Constitution and Britain is that it changes slowly. And therefore, we avoid the revolutions that happen all over Europe through the 19th century. Discuss, but I think there's, you know, there's some justice in it. Anyway, so you get... So then you get the crises at the beginning of the 20th century, the Parliament Bill, 1909-1911, Asquith and Lloyd George, our only Welsh Prime Minister, reduced the power of the House of Lords so they can only delay legislation. They can't delete it. And their finally, that balance of power has moved away from the House of Lords. Irish Home Rule under the Threat of Civil War and the Easter Rising, all delayed because of the First World War. Then in 1922, the Government of Ireland Act started the process of complete Irish independence. So 1918, universal male suffrage, men over 21, votes for women over 30. And then in 1920, they won the say, well, that's a bit daft, so it's everybody over 21.
Yeah, that's really not trying, is it? It's like, yeah, we're going to make that younger for us, but older for you. Yeah,
really a bit daft. Yeah, anyway. So...
Yeah.
There's been obviously quite a lot of change since then. So devolution is the big one, isn't it? We were talking about 1997. And that's a live issue, isn't it? I think devolution now. And it's very interesting about has it worked or not. And we can talk about
that. What did Boris Johnson say the other day?
Yeah, I always thought that
was the worst thing.
Yeah, I always thought that was the most extraordinary piece of non-news I think I've ever heard. So what, unionist Tory says he hates devolution. Is anybody surprised?
Unionist Tory angers the Scots even more so that they want to break free of the union.
Yeah, Scots look for events and everything as they have done for the last 300 years, breaking the union. I mean, against the union. I'm sorry, we've had this discussion before.
Fake
drives me out the wall. Anyway, there you go. Let's not have that one there. But I mean, there are some really interesting issues, aren't there? So in Brexit, we had the prorogation of Parliament attempt by Boris, which is just a fascinating case study, isn't it? Because here's the danger, perhaps, of not having a written constitution, because everything that has happened bit by bit. Under the demands of the time. And I think there's a very big movement that says this is wrong. We need to have a written constitution because it's custom and practice which drives a lot of decisions. And it doesn't say anywhere in a written piece of paper that the government of the day can't prorogue Parliament outside of the Parliament Act and without. And so, therefore, we need to have a written constitution. In actual fact, what happened?
How much actually being part of the European Union impacted on the constitution? Because I think that's one of the sort of problems that we might have had with the European Union is that we felt that it had more influence on Britain than it actually did. And maybe, you know, if there was a more clearly written constitution, it would be more obvious that actually Europe didn't have that much effect on a huge swathe of our laws, like, you know, health, education, law. There's a whole load of things that it really had no influence on whatsoever. And I think it just wasn't clear enough.
Actually, that's quite a fascinating point. I think I'm a bit torn on it because I'd say on one hand, the Constitution doesn't define law. You know, common law is defined by precedent and statute. So I don't think a constitution would cover that, but what it would cover is the principle that there is pooled sovereignty, presumably.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure it wouldn't make it worse, because that's the thing that people worried about, isn't it? That people like you and I think, say, look, the future is pooled sovereignty, and we just, you know, in intranational organizations are the future, especially if we're going to save the planet. We have to work together, and you know, or that's what I believe anyway, that... And actually, I think it might make it more obvious. And my argument about the written constitution is that you cannot legislate for everything in a written document. I would argue, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that every country in the world that has a written constitution meets situations which are not covered by that constitution. And that amending the constitution is very hard work. Whereas introducing a law to address one particular aspect that you've decided needs changing is much simpler. So I would argue that an unwritten constitution has dangers, but it has that big advantage that actually you can change piecemeal and slowly according to the circumstances of the day much more easily than some big attempt to amend the constitution discuss.
Yes, I know, because the American constitution does have a mechanism within it to amend itself.
Yes.
So I think which I think means that it is able to make any changes and react to different circumstances, because you know, I mean, not everything needs to be constitutional. I mean, Americans can create laws and legislate and do loads of things without making amendments. I mean, amendments seem to be about much more fundamental things, although some of them are I think some of the more recent ones have been about very little minor things. There have been loads, about 20 or something since, that we just don't know anything about.
Yeah,
the 1970s.
200 years or whatever. 250 years. I mean, you may well be right, and my knowledge of the American Constitution is, you know, it could be written on the inside of a ping pong ball. But all I can the thing that strikes me is this thing about the Equal Opportunities Act, or whatever it was called, about equal rights for women, essentially, and the fact that it still hasn't been passed, and basically everybody agrees with it, but, you know, it hasn't been passed yet. So
that wouldn't be an amendment. I mean,
that would be a constitutional amendment.
All the Equal Rights Acts all the Equal Rights Acts that came out in the 60s, I don't think they were amendments.
Okay.
I think, you know, a lot of those arguments were about the Constitution.
Okay. So I may be arguing out of my bottom. I'll bow to your superior knowledge. But I still think my point stands, that I don't think a constitution solves all your problems. People like precision, and I think it's a mistake, actually. I would go back to one of my opening statements and say vagueness is far more useful than precision, because if you've got a clear definition of something, you've got to stick to it. And changing it is a problem, and that becomes in itself an argument.
So, because I think one of another Brexit thing, but is, you know, the Good Friday Agreement, where, you know, an international agreement has superseded anything that we can do nationally.
I mean, it's a fascinating situation because, of course, you know, we all agree that the last thing on the earth we want to endanger is the Good Friday Agreement. You do not want the troubles back. But we're in an impossible situation. And I mean, the lack of debate was interesting. I don't know whether it would change anything, you know, in the referendum. But, you know, there is no answer to this problem. I mean, there is an answer in the sense of people just blagging it, just fudging the issue or trying to fudge the issue by having technical solutions. And that's what the British government and the DUP have argued all along. The people have doubted their ability to implement those technical, you know, those technical solutions of there being the impression of no border because technology solves it for you. But that is the only answer. You cannot expect, surely, a nation to say, oh, okay, so this part of this nation can hold us all to ransom over a democratically taken decision. You know, that's insupportable, and I can understand why that's insupportable to Brexiteers. On the other hand, the cost of starting the troubles again by having a hard border is insupportable, unthinkable. The only answer to that is what I think the British have been saying right from the beginning, which is that we have to find a solution through technology that makes the border look as though it doesn't exist. I would argue.
But, I mean, I think that sort of shows some of the influence of the EU was, you know, the Good Friday Agreement was signed while both nations were members of the European Union. So it felt like a sort of fairly sensible solution. And nobody foresew that we were going to have to join.
Because obviously it'd be bloody stupid to leave the European Union. I mean, absolutely. Yeah. And that is very interesting. So here we have a situation where European law is fundamentally, it's a European agreement, not law. And I think Jonathan Sumption argues, I don't know if I've recommended the Reith Lectures to 2019 before, it's very, very good though. So he argues that in actual fact, the amount of impact of EU law on British law is inconsequential. But nonetheless, it is there. Parliament is no longer sovereign. And that is a fundamental principle of our liberal democracy.
But that, wouldn't you say that also applies to NATO, for example? Because, I mean, according to the NATO agreements, if one nation is attacked, all nations have to react. And, places like Latvia are now members of NATO. So, according to the NATO treaty, if Russia attacked Latvia, which is fairly possible, we would all have to go and... whether we voted to fight a war against Russia over Latvia or not, we would have to because of an agreement,
treaty. So one of the principles of the British Constitution is that one parliament cannot bind the hands of a following parliament. So where a parliament has made a treaty, a following parliament can withdraw from that treaty. And, when it comes down to it, the Good Friday Agreement and this internal markets bill, we're all up in arms, but there's no reason why Britain cannot withdraw from the Good Friday Agreement if Parliament votes for it. I mean, what's happening here, obviously, the internal markets bill is they're trying to cheat and have it both ways. So, I mean, I'm not, I share what is presumably your fury about what they're doing. But in principle, we could... withdraw from the Good Friday Agreement.
And so we could withdraw from NATO. So in the situation I just gave, if Russia attacked Latvia, we'd have a quick vote and withdraw from NATO.
And there's all kinds of people who would argue that's exactly what we should have done in 1914, that none of our essential interests are being threatened by what's happening on the continent. We've spent a lot of time previous centuries trying to stay out of conflicts in Europe. And Lord Grey took us into the war, essentially, along with the cabinet, because he said that we could never hold our heads up again in the face of the world if we didn't stand by our treaties, which is interesting. Anyway, the other thing about the prorogation that I thought was particularly interesting was that one of the things that worries me about this Constitution is who is its guardian? So in America, obviously, you've got these famous, much lauded checks and balances. Actually, it looks to me as though America is almost in stasis, or unable to do anything. But and that's what we've always said here. We've said, look, okay, we don't want PR because and all that stuff, and because our system, first past the post, gives you stable government and strong executive power. But who guards the guards? Who is it, therefore, then, since the House of Lords no longer does and the monarch no longer does, who guards the Constitution from abuse by the executive? And you're left basically with the Supreme Court.
But hasn't that just...
Yes, that's very recent. The interesting thing at the prorogation thing is that however much I worry about what I think some clever person called single-chamber despotism and the absolute... dominance of central executive government. The executive, it can't be any other countries. Well, I'm sure there are sort of tyrannies and all the rest of it, but any liberal democracies where the power of the executive is so overwhelmingly strong as in the UK. And it seems to me that's the fluffed thing about devolution, actually, that far too much of funding comes from central government. At least in Scotland and Wales, they have the Barnett formula, so that's all devolved to them and they get to spend it apart from, what's still UK. Whereas if you're, your South Oxfordshire District Council or whatever, you 10% of your revenues are raised by locally. I mean, it's ridiculous. There's no local government at all. And that used to be one of the driving forces of in Victorian England was the strength of Birmingham and the Chamberlains and Manchester and Liverpool and the pride of local government, where they could really do things driven by local decisions. And we've got an absurdly over-centralized system in the UK at the moment. And devolution should have included devolution for England as well as Scotland and Wales.
Yes, because we're getting a very weird situation now with COVID, where, you know, you've got a health minister for Scotland, health minister for Wales, and then no one for England, because there's only a health minister for
Britain. Basically he's split. That person's job is split between thinking about England with one moment and thinking about Britain for another. And that's insupportable. We need we need an English first minister, and we need an English parliament in Birmingham or Manchester, or probably Loughborough would be a great candidate.
Almost the most obvious site to go.
Indeed, obviously, yes. It's in central. The country. Central. I mean, that's my view anyway, that you need somebody thinking about England in the way, so you've got somebody thinking about Scotland and somebody thinking about Wales. And this sort of fudge of English laws for England, it just makes the UK Parliament look even more dominated by such. And finally, my last rant is we need to get rid of bloody first past the sorting post. I mean, it's a joke, isn't it? I've lived in Headley.
Yes. Do you want to explain that just in case? Okay.
So we have a system based on constituencies and voting for an individual to represent us. And that I'm sure that worked in days gone by when we were small enough for, and the structure of society was such that personal relationships and hierarchies were very important and very influential. But although, you know, many of those have exploded, you know, we still think we're a class-ridden society, and to a degree we are, but nothing like it used to be, and nothing like the system was designed under. So what you get is, for me, you don't know what you're voting for when you're voting for the Labour Party. And in actual fact, what's happening at the moment, that since the numbers signing up to become a member of political parties falling very dramatically, what you've got is that the loonies are in charge of each of the parties. You know, the Blue Rinse Brigade in charge of the Tories, the Momentum nutters of far left donkey jacket wearers are in command of the Labour Party, and of course the Liberal Democrats. They still are. Did you see them? I mean, unbelievable. People saying, oh, this is an outrage, Corbyn being jacked out of the party. I mean, it's just,
I know.
You know, where is your brain? Anyway, and of course, the Liberal Democrats, well, nobody votes for a third party because, you know they're never going to make a breakthrough. So it's a wasted vote. And
the Green.
And the Green parties, you know, there's so much impetus or potential support for the Green Party, because you know your vote is wasted, they don't have anything like the representation they should have.
Yes, I mean, I think it works out that it's 800,000 votes to get one member of parliament from the Green Party compared to 25,000 or something for a Conservative.
Absolutely bonkers, whereas at least in the PR that everybody has used throughout Europe, you split up into different parties, but the experience is that actually you have to create consensus and have a discussion in order to build up consensus across those parties. And you know who you're voting for. You know what they believe, because the range within that church is so much narrower. So I think first past the post is a disaster, and I think you can't really change politics without it. Jonathan Sumption's argument is that a broad church is a fundamental aspect of a functioning democracy, because within that broad church and within parties, you have to make compromises in order to create your manifesto. And that's where the compromise happens. But then if membership of parliaments is falling, of parties is falling, then you don't have any anymore, because it's the lunatics driving the bus. So you don't get any. So you get things like the absurdity of Jeremy Corbyn and the fact that we haven't had an effective
opposition. I don't disagree about the lunatics driving the bus. But, I mean, in the case of the Labour Party, I think their membership grew massively under Corbyn.
But it's all the loonies that joined. I mean, you also had a process after that of of loads of people leaving the party of the moderates. And hopefully you're getting the same thing now. The moderates are rejoining, and the left wing loonies are leaving. There's a lovely thing about you can see the NEC if that's what it's still called, the executive, National Executive of the Labour Party. And 13 members left, boycotted the meeting. And they said it was the best meeting they'd had for years. Yeah. Boycotting is the daftest strategy on earth. Anyway, there you go. Anyway, that's me ranting for the centrist point of view. But it does seem to me that the British Constitution, there are many, many questions about it at the moment. How do you protect it? Is the Supreme Court good enough? What executive power, it seems to me, is way too strong. We're far too centralised, and local government needs more power, and our voting system sucks. And there needs to be an English, proper English devolution. Here endeth the lesson for the prosecution.
I think that's absolutely fantastic. So are we going to have to debate whether it goes into the cabinet or not?
We could debate. What do you think?
Well, I'm thinking that, but it doesn't actually exist. So how could it possibly go in the cabinet if it's a non-existent document?
Well, it is. We do have a British constitution. It's just that it's not written down.
Right. But you know, yes. But there'll be no, because I think it was something I asked before, is there a definition of it? It does seem very nebulous. I'm just trying to make an argument here.
Yes, it does. I mean,
but anyway,
it is quite nebulous, but it's interpreted by the courts, essentially, if there's a dispute about what it is. It is laid down by precedent, custom and statute law. And it is, you know, that we know what the main element, constitutional elements are, monarchy, parliament, and the judiciary. You know, I think we kind of know what it is. For me, the only question is whether the different elements have got out of kilter and need updating. I don't feel that we would solve our problems by having a written constitution. I think we'd create more problems than we solve.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it'd be one of those monumental waste of time as well.
God, can you imagine? Oh, wow. Anyway, it's got to go in.
Okay.
It's got to go in, surely. I mean, it's the very fundamental thing about, and it's one of those things, actually, that the British have always been very, or the English as well, in particular, have always been very proud about. Whether they're right to be quite so proud, I don't know. But what it has helped deliver is gradual change without a lot of the violence of revolutions. And an age-old problem, actually, that they discussed at the time of Richard II is it better to suffer tyranny or that people should die in rebellion? And that's a good question, isn't
it? Yes. And also, I mean, you know, when you end up with Napoleon out of the French Revolution, it doesn't necessarily play very well. Or
certainly, if you look across the European revolutions of the 19th century, almost exclusively, and this is why, of course, Trotsky was killed, wasn't it? And why, you know, the likes of Lenin talked about and Marx talked about permanent revolution, is that after the revolution comes a reassertion, the middle classes always win. The forces of conservatism reestablish themselves. And that happened time and time again in Europe in the 19th century. So you get death and massive destruction. And then you get a tyrant like Boney. Anyway, I vote go into the cabinet. But we should put it to a vote of the people.
Very good, yes. And of course, here on the Facebook site of the Things That Made England, we are very much a one-person, one-vote organisation, and every vote counts. And so we'll pause here for a moment to listen to our Facebook roundup from our last show.
Gloriana, good Queen Bess, Elizabeth the First. Far, far back, virtually last year, Luke and David argued the odds on whether she was good or bad or relevant or not. I began the podcast with Elizabeth I's iconic speech at Tilbury, which was fulfilling a long, long dream for me, not being at Tilbury about to fight the Armada, but doing the speech. Then Luke and David swept in and promptly, in very English fashion, apologised to each other. First, David apologised for being brilliant, and then Luke apologised, and then David returned the apology with a few mild insults thrown in. Honestly, you couldn't find a more English way to podcast if you tried. In between the apologies, they discussed Elizabeth I, and all that was missing was Roy Field calling everybody Sir. We're deeply aware that you have had to wait patiently for a new show, For about as long as Elizabeth's counsellors had to wait on her decision on whether she was going to get married or not, or yes or no, and who to, but not him, and then her decision on who would succeed her, maybe James or Arabella or nobody, or maybe she'll get married. And for your long, long wait, I apologise. Inevitably, after such a long wait, there was a brief vote and scramble of discussions, and we veered off the topic, the way you do. Not before we voted, though. There were 69 votes for putting Gloriana into the cabinet, 4 for no thank you very much, and 2 for a very non-committal, well, she was all right. So, in Elizabeth I goes, cramming her skirts and her wig into what must now be an enormously tight space, right next to Maggie Thatcher. That's going to be a bust-up I'd like to witness. They'll be hurling brown sauce at each other within minutes. As I said, underneath the post about voting, there is a brief flurry of comments about Elizabeth I, and then we veered right off topic, and Rowena Card posted a wonderful map of Britain and what the various areas call woodlice. There was a big discussion on whether they are roly-polies or slaters or dampers or chuggy pigs. And Jacqueline Berteau pointed out that, according to the map, Lincolnshire and Yorkshire must just call them woodlice. I'll have to message my daughter in North Lincolnshire to ask her what her Yorkshire-born children call them. Alison, for whom they are slaters, suggested we should do a similar map for daps or sand shoes, or what some people call sneakers and others trainers, a plimsoll line. I hope somebody who's clever will get on to it. By the way, for me, they will always be daps. I would be terribly remiss, especially as our subject was Good Queen Bess, if I didn't mention the gorgeous post that Mandy Cheevers shared from another site of our Good Queen Bess rendered as a Christmas tree. It made me feel more than a little inadequate with my decorating. Luke began a post asking folk to show off their trees, so I do hope that you'll get on there and show us your Hanukkah, Christmas, solstice or Kwanzaa displays. That would be fun to see. And we had a very silly time responding to a shared tweet posted by Eric Trometer on whether British people still do the accent when nobody else is around. It got quite daft. And for some reason, we all came to the conclusion we speak like Texans when no one's around. So do jump into the discussion, or begin one. We who serve you will do our level best to be better at this and add more podcasts in a more timely manner. Yes, I'm promising that on behalf of the entire team. Until then, I'll end in a traditional English way and say I'm sorry. Sorry? Terribly sorry. Well, I'm sorry. Sorry. Terribly sorry.
We do have one quite important announcement to make, and that is that we have now got a Patreon site, and it's patreon.com.
Okay.
Yeah. As of about 3 hours ago. Yeah, well, patreon.com /TTME. And you can join up if you feel that way inclined. And we will be very grateful.
Very good.
Well, thank you very, very much, David.
Okay, we have delighted our audience enough,
yeah,
yes.
I think that was fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Cry God for Harry.
And these are the things that made England.
And St. George.
These are the things that made England.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.